Welcome to One True Podcast. My name is Mark Chirino, and my producer is Michael Von Cannon. In his memoir, A Movable Feast, Ernest Hemingway wrote, "All you have to do is write one true sentence. Write the truest sentence that you know." So finally, I would write one true sentence and then go on from there. In that same spirit of honesty, creativity, and curiosity, One True Podcast explores all things related to Ernest Hemingway, his life, his work, and his world. For this episode, we are privileged to welcome someone who has a perspective on Ernest Hemingway's life, work, world, and also personality like no other. We are joined by Valerie Hemingway. Irish-born, Valerie Hemingway was educated in Dublin. While working as a cub reporter in Madrid in 1959, she was sent to interview Ernest Hemingway, who later offered her a summer job as a secretary. The job extended through 1960, and after Hemingway's death in 1961, Mary Hemingway hired Valerie for the massive and massively important task of archiving Hemingway's papers. She worked in publishing and public relations in New York for almost two decades before moving to Montana with her husband, Gregory Hemingway, Ernest's youngest son, and their children. Her memoir, Running with the Bulls, recounts her time with the Hemingways. Valerie, we're so happy to have you with us.
Thank you very much, Mark.
And Valerie, it is with Running with the Bulls that we'll be using as a touchstone for our conversation. So we've selected some passages from Valerie's book to use as guideposts through Hemingway's summer of 1959. Valerie, we'll be using your words to trace that experience and then invite you to expand on some of those memories, as long as that's okay.
That's a good plan.
And Valerie, I think the place I want to start is for you to establish the setting of that magic summer of 1959. And you write, "Spain instantly won my heart." So tell us a little bit about that atmosphere where you met Hemingway.
Well, as you mentioned, I grew up in Ireland, and there was an affinity between Ireland and Spain. They were both Catholic countries, both in the north part, the Basque country was sort of Celtic, the same as Ireland. So we always had an affinity, and I had wanted to go. And when I was 16, I had the opportunity to go with my uncle and spent perhaps 5 or 6 days. It was a continental trip. And I was very touched by Spain. When you see my first time out of Ireland, I went to England, France, Spain, and Portugal. And of the four countries, Spain touched my heart. And so I knew that I wanted to go back there, but I didn't realize that actually 2 years later, when I was 18, I would go back to Spain and really immersed myself in that culture. It was so different from Ireland. I mean, just if you started with the weather, the sunshine, which is a very short commodity in Ireland. And then I had, in fact, read The Sun Also Rises. And that had been intriguing to me because it was unlike anything I'd ever read. It was not like, it was banned in Ireland, as was For Whom the Bell Tolls. And but I had a great interest in journalism, so it might have been more the journalism, the just the way people talk, the vernacular. So that was I didn't even connect it with it that it was written by an American. So when I was sent to interview Hemingway, we got started on my one question. The premise of it, I was given the question. I was very naive in many ways, and my boss would give me a page of questions, and I would go and find the person, or sometimes I did these interviews on the telephone, and would ask the questions without doing any background check. I didn't know enough to know that one ought to know a lot more. So when I asked Ernest his question, which was about his returning to Spain, which I thought was for the first time since the Spanish Civil War. He was astounded, I think, at my ignorance, but was sort of kind enough not to bawl me out about it. And we got talking about an affinity towards Spain and things Spanish, and about, he asked me, you know, where have you been in Spain and so on. And it was he who emphasized for me that if you're in a country, you must learn everything about that country, forget all about where you've come from. And it struck me, you know, I mean, growing up in Ireland, one was taught to listen and not ask questions. So it was just very nice to be told something that was both interesting and useful. And so it was only after meeting Hemingway that I put together really not just an interest and liking of Spain, but a determination to not only soak up the culture and study the literature as well.
When you're saying that you were sent to interview Hemingway for the first time, which in 1959 for many people would have been an awesome, overwhelming assignment. You also write in Running with the Bulls, "I didn't have the built-in reverence his name evoked for young and old alike. I did not worship at the Hemingway shrine." I think Ernest found this refreshing. So although you had read some of his books ahead of time, you were approaching him very much like another human being, and you were able to relate to him on that level. Is that true?
That's true. I had turned 19 the week before I interviewed him, and I had read The Sun Also Rises, which was called Fiesta in the English edition, when I was, it was between 15 and 16. I had pilfered it, but that's a little story in my book. But and as I say, it was just different from anything. But the first time I ever heard the name Hemingway was when I was 12. On my 12th birthday, my mother, I was in a boarding school, so one got the day off, the day out, if your parents happened to be around. And my mother came to school and took me out and took me to see the afternoon show of For Whom the Bell Tolls. And my mother was very strict about all things cultural and literary and dramatic and so on. And so I had to learn, I think before I went to the movie, I had to learn the name For Whom the Bell Tolls and the name Ernest Hemingway, which was quite an unusual name for Ireland. And so I remembered, so I memorized these because this was part of the deal with my mother. And it wasn't until actually after I spent time with Ernest in Spain that I read For Whom the Bell Tolls, which actually is one of my favorite books. And one of the things about For Whom the Bell Tolls is, and I think people who understand Spanish might well feel the same. When I read it, I almost read it, and certainly the dialogue I read in Spanish, it automatically translates into Spanish when I'm reading it. And that's why sometimes people say the dialogue is, it's so strange, you know, it seems a bit stilted and odd and old fashioned, but actually what it is an absolute, it's the vernacular in English, which of course, obviously that I wouldn't have known until I was living in Spain and knew how to read Spanish. So, so when I met Hemingway, apart from at 12 and at 15 to 16, reading the reading Fiesta, I really didn't. And in those days, one never thought about the author of a book. Today, we have a great author culture. I mean, now you know the author more than you know the contents of the book. I know people who tell me they're great Hemingway fans, and when you ask what they read, you know, they almost look at you and say, "Well, we know the writer." You know? But it's the life that people love. And but Hemingway, the writer, you know, I really didn't have that connect between For Whom the Bell Tolls, Fiesta, and Hemingway the first time I met him. Of course, when you travel with someone, his literature was part of his personality. And so then they became part of the person. But when I first met him, he was just another writer. And I had happened to be very lucky. I grew up in a way among writers. My family, we lived in the summers with distant cousins who had a small hotel in County Wicklow. And we milled around with the guests. And there were a lot of writers, actors, singers, and so on. There. And so when I met Hemingway, it was just another person. I didn't even think of him as being someone famous.
Well, the reason I find that so interesting is because in your book, you present Hemingway, first of all, as what you're just describing, that he found it refreshing that he was able to relate to somebody who wasn't awestruck. But on the other hand, you also, the portrait that you render of Hemingway is also somebody who never forgets that he's Hemingway. And so he loved being, he loved receiving the adulation and respect that being Hemingway, being a Nobel Prize winner, earned him. How do you render that balance when it comes to Hemingway as both somebody who expected a certain reaction from people, but also enjoyed not getting that reaction?
Well, I think he probably was a bit ambivalent himself about it. I mean, he certainly wanted his literature to be recognized, but he didn't want people prying into his private life. And he really tried to draw a line. For instance, when he asked me to work for him, the only restriction was, if you work for me, you do not write about my life. You know, if you are privy to my household and my life, you don't write about it. But he added, because Ernest was always, he always gave you, you know, the stick and the carrot. So he added, but if you do spend time with me, and you will learn about writing, you'll learn about life in a way that you are not going to do sitting at home and going and doing the occasional interviews. So that, you know,
exactly.
The one that, but basically, he told me a lot about his life because a good part of my work was he would dictate his letters, both business and personal. And he always, what was wonderful about Ernest was that he never put you in the dark, kept you in the dark, or assumed that you knew a lot of things, well, say personal things. He would give me, whoever he was writing to, there was no need for him to do it, but he would give me the background of that person and how he knew them and what they meant to him and so on. So that he felt that even just transcribing something that he was saying, it had to be meaningful, because for him, words were meaningful.
Yes.
You know, I had a great respect for words too. So we had a connection there, and personality really didn't come into it.
Valerie, when I read your book, one of the things that I found most astounding is much like what you're describing, which is I kept asking myself, how would Hemingway have agreed to such a setup of just inviting somebody essentially off the streets into his life as a confidant? To quote you one more time, you write in your book, trust was a quality he valued most in those surrounding him. And I'm thinking, how is this arrangement? It seemed organically to emerge from a young woman that he just met for the first time. Looking back on it, are you shocked that it materialized in the way that it did?
Well, I think that first conversation, it became slightly personal in the sense that here, clearly, I knew nothing about the Spanish Civil War and his returning and Franco. These were things I had just asked the question, and when there was nothing to be filled in, I couldn't carry on a conversation about Spain, its history, and his literature. So we talked about Ireland. And he had never been there, but he had one particular great friend from Ireland, Captain Eric Dorman Smith, who later became Dorman O'Gowan. and he really wanted to know about Ireland. And I was able to fill him in, and I did know a lot about my own, the literature, the poetry, the drama, and so on, of my own country. And he loved that. And of course, when he asked me who was my favorite writer, I told him James Joyce. James Joyce, like his own work, Joyce's work was banned in Ireland. So I had, when I was 17 and went over to, well, actually, it must have been that time I was 16 and went over to England, I came back with a copy, which I still have, of Ulysses, 10 and sixpence. That was a lot of money in those days. That's half a dollar. That was about 55 cents. And so I, because it was banned, I put brown paper, which all school children, your school books had brown paper covers on them. And I put mathematics on it. And of course, it sailed right through the customs and the immigrant, whatever, the people. And you know, these were, I told him a few vignettes as well of how I borrowed, which really meant stole his fiesta, you know. And so I told him a few of these stories, and that got us through. It was just 30 minutes, that first interview. And he was very disciplined, and when he did things, he said, I'll give you 30 minutes. And Mary was with him, his wife at the time when I came in, and Juanito Quintana, who was also doing some work for him in terms of travel and arranging the Spanish tickets for the bullfights and so on. And so he dismissed Mary and Juanito, but exactly 30 minutes later, they walked in the door.
Wow.
Because that's the way Ernest was. I mean, one gets the impression that I'm always astounded when I read the books that people or the interviews, you know, because it seems like he was what we called in Ireland a messer. He was someone who was, you know, unreliable. You get this sort of someone who's careless. And actually, his personality, if you were with him day after day, as I was, for quite many, many months, you find someone who is actually very disciplined, very tidy, neat in both in his person and in his mind, you know?
Also with his writing, you would think that he was disciplined, and his, did you find his habits, even traveling through Spain, his writing habits to be disciplined?
Absolutely. But his writing was a very private thing. And so that I never actually saw him writing, because he did that on his own early in the morning. And that was put away. And this is, it's funny, because when you think of the personality, because the person that most people saw was someone who's sitting, drinking, carousing, having a good time.
Right.
Whereas, because that private, his writing was his most personal and private time. And I don't think he ever wrote around other people. I mean, at least as when I knew him, he had to have a sanctuary, a private place where he wrote, same place every day. And then that was put away, and he didn't discuss it, because he felt he had all sorts of little superstitions, you know, a pebble in his pocket, a rabbit's foot, various things, an elk's tooth, all sorts of things I was introduced to that you don't expect in the course of work. And but he put away the writing, because he also felt that the mind should just rest. If you're working on something, especially if it's something creative, that it's sort of it's like putting the stew on to simmer. And then he would take it up the next day. But he never, ever wanted to discuss what he had written until he felt that is a fait accompli, that's it. And so this, I mean, I learned all sorts of things that were just things you pick up when you're around somebody for a period of time.
Your description of Hemingway as a writer leads me to one other remark that you make in your book that I have a couple of questions about. So you write, I can say from observation that Ernest lived for his writing. Writing was the core of his existence, and when his writing ability finally faltered, he saw no reason to continue. And one of the striking things about that remark is that you're talking about Hemingway in 1959, and then you're also seeing Hemingway the next year and comparing him to not a great deal of time passes between those two moments, but you think you're seeing a much different Hemingway and a much different attitude to his own writing. Is that true?
Yes. Well, I think, it was, if you took it as two chapters of a book or whatever, the year 1959, the year 1960 was so different in every way. 59 was the public Hemingway. He was in the limelight all the time because even though we stayed at the villa, La Consola, belonging to the Davises in Malaga, just outside of Malaga, and even though he did have his private quarters there, there were always 10, 12, 14 people to dinner. He was surrounded by people. There was the bullfights. There were the bullfighters. There was the public Hemingway. And he was mostly charming, but of course, every now and then you do get annoyed at different things. He had a short temper. He knew this. This was one of his faults, lifelong faults, that he acknowledged and tried to deal with. But very often, not very often, but often enough, he would fly off the handle, because I think people who are very creative are also very sensitive. And so they get stirred up very easily. They're not, I'm making a generality, but I mean, anyway, Hemingway was that way.
So what irritated Hemingway?
Well, what irritated him was being interrupted, especially if he were talking, he had a train of thought and he was talking, or if he equally, he was listening, because he listened equally to talking, because he felt listening was one of the great necessities for any writer, is that you need to listen even more than you talk. So he was very good at that. But then being interrupted by miscellaneous people and in a public place, of course, Spain in the summertime, you're eating outside al fresco the whole time. And consequently, and with his beard, with people knowing he was in Spain, it was the beginning of the publicity era. People felt you could just come up and interrupt, and that would set him flying off the handle. I know after my book came out, somebody wrote me and said that Ernest threatened to knock him down when he asked him for an autograph. But I think I replied, you were probably the 55th person who had done it in an hour. Yeah. And, but for you, it was your only encounter. And he remembered that and just said, you're like, what a horrible person you worked for. You know, that was one of the things. Other things was that if people pried into his life, wanted to, or criticized overly, that would make him
cry. Right. He was sensitive to that. But we were talking about his devotion to his writing, and you were saying that there was a big gap between 59 and 60. So 59, when you met Hemingway, he was still focused on his writing, enthusiastic and energetic, and was able to concentrate on his project. Is that so?
There were two different years in the sense that his activities were different. Spain was very public, and mainly he was gathering information. And he was in the mornings, okay. He would write down his impressions and of the bullfights, especially because he had been commissioned to do, two articles for Life magazine on the bullfighting season. So that was reportage, and it was, that was paying for their 6 months in Spain. And so he was very serious about his journalism. I mean, the journalism and the creative writing were two different things. Now, in Spain in 59, he wasn't doing his creative writing, But what he was doing was he had two manuscripts with him. He had one was a movable feast, and the other one was what became the Garden of Eden. And he was, when we went to France, in both cases, because both of those were set in France mainly, then he took his manuscripts and carefully went over the manuscripts, and both remembering he wanted to capture, to make sure that he didn't make any glaring mistakes of someone, if someone lived there, that it was as if a Frenchman had written, whether it was Paris or whether it was the south of France, the Garden of Eden. So there was that. So I did see that part of the creative writing. Now, in 1960, then he was writing up. So it was more sitting in his home at his desk, putting together these things. So it was a different, in a way, it was a different type of writing. It was the more sitting down, it was more technical. And then the pressures of life really engulfed him in 1960. So he was, in 59, he was a very carefree person.
How so? What was going on in 1960 that got to Hemingway?
Well, it was the political situation in Cuba was what got to him, you know. Herbert Matthews came down. Herbert Matthews, as you know, was a New York Times reporter who they had met in Spain during the Spanish Civil War, become good friends. And Herbert had been covering Cuba, and he came to the Finca to tell Ernest that he had requested from the Times that they transfer him to a different part. It was a different part of South America, and he said that it was untenable, that the relationship between the States and Cuba was untenable, and that he couldn't, he was not free to report what he saw was going on. He had been with Castro, Matthews had been with Castro in the Sierra before he came down at the beginning of the revolution. So he made a huge coup for the Times. And he still, in 1960, believed in Castro, and the Estates had definitely cut off. And so this was very disturbing to Ernest, and not because of the political situation, because of his personal situation. It meant it was going to be untenable for him to continue living in Cuba. That was it.
It affected his writing, his emotions. And so from 1959 to 1960, massive difference in how you found Hemingway.
Yeah.
Yeah. Valerie, I want to say as a detour to this, I was watching the Ken Burns documentary of Hemingway, Ken Burns and Lynn Novick, and I'm watching all of this footage consecutively. So his life is sort of thrown out consecutively where I get to consider it. And what struck me is that even when Hemingway, let's say later 1940s, early 1950s, so long before you met him, it seems like he had aged way past his chronological years.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the phrase that's used in the documentary is battered by life, which I think is a very interesting phrase. But did you find him that way? We could talk about his epic 60th birthday party. But did you find him to be older, physically older than his years?
I would say definitely. If I look back at it now, well, of course, then when I met Ernest and he was 59, that seemed aged to me. I mean, that was another century. I mean, he was born in another century, and I thought he was ancient anyway. So, but looking now, because I can remember one day in New York, I was walking down the street, and who should come towards me but Bumby? Bumby actually didn't look that much like his dad, but he said, "Val, do you know that I'm the same age now that my dad was when you met him?" And he had still had his fair hair, and he was, you know. But I think also we have to admit that in the past 60, 70 years, people are more youthful. You know, what do they say? You know, 60 is the new 40 or something like that. But we all are. But definitely, if you look at pictures of Ernest and of his contemporaries, he did take a beating. I think in terms of how he looked in 1959, 1960, it had to do with the two crashes in Africa. I think that really, if you look at he aged very much after 1954.
What were the physical or emotional manifestations of those crashes as you saw it?
Well, you know, I mean, I didn't obviously meet, you know, you only learn things gradually. So I didn't know probably till I was in Cuba the next year, 1960. That's when I probably learned about the crashes and the difficulty. Because one of the things that he told me, and I don't know if it concurs with how scholars have looked at it, but he told me very definitely that it was in 1954 when he came back from Africa, back when they got back, it was, I think, close to the end of the year when they got back to Cuba, and that it was then for the first time he thought, you know, that his life was shortened and might soon end, and that he should... think about his memoirs. That was the first time that he thought about what became A Movable Feast. And it was when he said, when I was lying on my back and I couldn't go up and I couldn't do the exercise, you know, when I was recuperating and still in great pain, I began to think about those years in Paris, those years. And I felt that I needed to write them down. And then I think it was in 56 he told me he started it then, and that when he got the papers when he went back to Paris, and he knew he'd left the trunk there, and that then he found so much of the writing that he was able to incorporate, that it was writing that he actually done in his 20s. And that, I think that's one of the most magical books of any kind, or a memoir, A Movable Feast. For some reason, I always laugh. There are parts there that I think are hilarious. You know, the Hilaire Belloc one. There are various little chapters that are just gems. You know, it was a wonderful thing that he came back to that, because he managed, it was sort of like a circle. He managed to tie up and to recoup some of that brilliance that he had.
You must like, in A Movable Feast, his treatment of James Joyce and how much he respected your favorite writer.
Our friendship was solidified on what he called, you know, James Joyce. And he said, oh, Jim, my old friend Jim, you know, and he loved to talk about it, because he was, in a way, a youngster. He was in his, what we'd call now a youngster, he was in his early 20s when he met Joyce, and how he would sort of, Joyce was the person that he listened to and admired. Yeah. And of course, there is no connection in any way between, say, Joyce's writing and Hemingway's writing, except that they were geniuses. They were both geniuses, and they wrote from their knowledge. You know, Joyce, I often, when I read, I try to read Ulysses every 10 years. And I'm amazed. I say, how could someone who hadn't grown up in Dublin really understand that book? Because just the way when you read Hemingway, say, A Movable Feast, you can walk down the streets of Paris. You can see, you feel you're in that city.
Right.
The same way with Joyce. I mean, even more so. I can smell Dublin. I can feel it. I can see it. I can hear it when I read Joyce. And it's a similar thing with me. A Movable Feast brings me right back to Paris.
I feel the same way about the Michigan woods, how he evokes that, even for somebody who's never been to Michigan, those woods. You know, when you say that Hemingway was a genius, is that something you know from reading his writing, or is that something that you could just tell from sitting down and having a drink with him and listening to him speak and following the way that he thinks?
Well, I would have to be honest and say that it's more the writing. It's just so many people have tried to copy him, and you can see that I think all writers or all painters, especially, you copy in order to learn. You have to have some sort of basis of knowledge and learning and trying and proving. But with Hemingway, I sort of, in a way, disconnect his personality from his writing, in the sense that his personality is he was a very charming person, not in the practical sense of charming, you know, in that he smiled and was gracious, but there was something very, very authentic and kind. There was something gentle. It was both gentle. It was gentle generally in the right places, and then anger. I mean, he showed his emotions. He did burst forth, and sometimes a bit precipitously, which he knew. But I think if you're going to be a great writer or a great anything, you have to have this. You're not going to be able to be. Well, this is what I learned from Hemingway, was that you can't just be a person in an armchair with, in those days, it was a pencil and paper. I mean, that's when he wrote. He always wrote first pencil and paper, and then typed up what he wrote, because the typewriter was secondary. And but you can't be a great writer if you haven't done, if you haven't actually felt and lived and had that anger and had the sorrow and had the laughter and had it. You have to have all these experiences. You have to allow whatever's in you, your spirit, to absorb all these things and feel them. And then sometimes his emotions spilt over from, just not from the page, but he got angry about things and he got happy about things. And that was something, because I grew up in a society where I'm sure people did all these things, but they didn't show it. I mean, about the what they showed most of their personality after they'd had a few drinks. But Ernest wasn't like that, because, I mean, in the sense that, of course, he drank. I mean, we all drank in those days. That was sort of the hallmark of, in a way, of journalism and writing, was being able to hold your drink was a big part of it. But that was the least. When people said to me, Hemingway, oh, he was such a terrible drinker. Well, I said, which it's slightly funny, but it's not. I said, which was absolutely true. Hemingway was a moderate drinker in my knowledge of drinkers. So,
wow. Well, Valerie, maybe that is a perfect lead-in to this notorious 60th birthday party, which you render so beautifully in your memoir. And there's that famous picture. There's that. Actually, let me read a little passage and perhaps get your reaction. Mary rented a shooting gallery from a traveling carnival, and it became the main attraction when Ernest, to the horror and fascination of the onlookers, blasted the ash from Antonio's lighted cigarette with a .22 rifle as the matador held the butt between his lips. Now, were you an eyewitness to that?
Absolutely. I mean, I couldn't believe it. The only thing is that with Ernest, a suspension of reality and belief. When he did things, you didn't at that moment think, oh, he's doing something extraordinary. It was just, I was thrown into a life that I could not have imagined. And even since then, in a way you thought, oh, well, this is the beginning. This is how adults behave. Again, I was 19 right. In a couple of months at that time. And, I thought, well, this is what life is. Now I'm really seeing how it is. It's not like sitting in the, with your, not with your knees crossed, but sitting straight in a chair and listening to people as one did in Ireland. It's out there with your gun shooting your best friend. I mean, he was very, very fond of Antonio, and he literally shot it. And this was after having dinner and lots of drinks. And I thought, like, both of those, but of course, both of those men were extraordinary, and it was both brave and foolish. And, you know, I think that's part in it. Maybe bravery always has a little bit of foolishness in it.
And who's being braver, Antonio or Hemingway?
Well, I would say Antonio, because his life was insane. But that was part of his métier, part of his work, was that you put your life in danger. So I think, you know, there is a correlation here between Ernest is in this case the bull, and Antonio is the brave bullfighter. But that was, I mean, that is an evening that of course stands out in my memory. It was supposed in my life, you know, as the perhaps the most exciting and unusual and strange and exotic the evening that I ever spent. There was music. I have a picture of Antonio and his wife, Carmen. It was Carmen's 30th birthday, Ernest's 60th birthday. And they're doing some flamenco dancing to the music, the two of them. And it was a magical evening. There were fireworks, and then one of the trees caught fire, and then the firemen came, but it was just a sizzle, you know. The fire was out. When the firemen came, they were all given drinks, and then people like Beverly Bentley took a fireman's hat and put it on. And you know, the firemen suddenly, they wouldn't have known what happened to them. They come at the middle of the night to this call, and they find themselves sort of dancing and drinking and carrying on. It was just amazing. And Mary had, I mean, she'd gone to tremendous trouble, and there was supposed to be 30 people. And I think there were quite a few more than that, because Ernest was, at the last few days up in Pamplona, he invited various, I mean, they were people who he met that had connections, like Susie and Hugh Millet. Hugh was a grandson of the great painter, Millet. But they were complete strangers, and Ernest just took to them and said, come to my birthday party. There were a number, and again, indeed, Beverly Bentley, the American actress who later married and then divorced from Norman Mailer, and was a great friend of mine. When I first came, I stayed with Beverly in New York, but we were great friends until her death about a year ago. She was 90 when she died. But Mary was dismayed, although she'd been married long enough to Ernest, longer than any of his other three wives, so she shouldn't have ever been dismayed about Ernest's behavior. But he was very generous, and he liked people. But on the other hand, then when he got tired of them, he wanted them to disappear. You know, he was very generous in saying, you know, come and join me, do this and that. But then he expected them to just sort of disappear as if off stage, you know, goodbye,
exactly.
You know, on your way.
Yeah. Well, the scene, as you write it in your book, is one of euphoria and bedlam, which is made all the more striking for when, as we get later, who could have predicted that 1960? And then, of course, 1961, it's not that far away, and the story is going to change very much. Valerie, I see that we're getting a little bit close to the end, but there was one thing maybe we could use as a concluding remark. And one of my favorite lines in your memoir is when you write, he had the most inquiring mind of anyone I've met. And the reason that strikes me is because you often get a caricature of Hemingway as a kind of the papa, know-it-all, swaggering figure, which you acknowledge he could be at times. But at the heart of it, It seems like somebody genuinely curious about you, about Ireland, about life, about Spain. And that was the kind of investigation that drove his writing and his genius. And maybe you could talk about that kind of opposition between the Papa figure, but also that inquisitive mind.
Well, I found that one of the things was that he made every minute count. It was something that, would be so useful if everybody had this. But for instance, in the morning, now we turn on the radio or whatever we have, and somebody tells us how it's going to be. But for him, weather was a very important thing, because depending on the weather, you decided what your activities would be. But if it was going to be a beautiful day, you might say, well, I'm going to quit writing, quit working early and go out and have a lovely time. So he would go out, he would go out every morning, check the weather, check the state of the world, as it were, the plants, the birds. I was so amazed that, the things that one gets up and you say, I must have a cup of coffee, I must turn on the news, that. But he used the world as his canvas or his dictionary. The way he used life was something that I've never before nor since seen another person do. He had every minute was for the living, and it had a purpose. And when he met people, they weren't just hear somebody come in to annoy me. He liked artisans. He liked people. It didn't matter what you did. If you came in to mop the floor, he might be interested in that. You might have something that would always, every human being had a value for him, which was another thing that you don't often get. And he would ask questions of people, and he would listen to them. He wouldn't just ask a question the way often people, you ask someone, how are you today? And then you go on with the next thing. If he said, how are you today? He meant, how are you, Yeah. It was not just an idle thing. I mean, I grew up in a society where we had lots of, there was a sort of polite conversation. There was a script for everything you did. And those things really were meaningless, because when you say, how are you? You really didn't care how the person was. That was what you had to do to get on to the next thing. But what I found about Ernest was that he lived in a way that I've never, ever seen any other person live like that. That life had a special meaning over and above the mundane. The word boring didn't come up in the couple of years that I knew him, because there's just so much. Life is so, every minute could be filled with half a dozen things. So that even when we went to the bullfights, which we did, probably went to close to 50 bullfights with him in Spain in the 59, Spain and south of France in the end of the season. And he did not want you to go to that bullfight unless you knew what the weather was, the arena, what type of the arena, the bulls, what ganaderia they came from, what bull farm, who the toreros were, what was their background. And so for me, it was fascinating. So instead of going to some, people would say to me later, bullfights, how boring. But when you had to do your homework for Hemingway, when you knew the context and you knew how important this was and you knew where it stood in this person's, in their career, and sometimes even their background. And so everything was sort of, my mind was so teeming with stuff.
Well, Valerie, thank you so much for making Hemingway come alive for us today. This has been such a delightful conversation.
It's been a pleasure.
And thanks to you all for listening in. This episode is available on HemingwaySociety.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at OneTruePod. That's the number OneTruePod. Or email us at OneTruePod@gmail.com. Our show is supported by the Hemingway Society the English Department of the University of Evansville, and Florida Gulf Coast University. Join us next time as we continue exploring Hemingway, his work, and his world. Until then, I'm Mark Chirino with Michael Von Cannon, and this is One True Podcast.